This is Festival Showcase, a weekly program exclusively on Aspen Public Radio, where we talk to the musicians, composers, conductors, and the movers and shakers from the Aspen Music Festival and School during the festival season. Fridays at 2:30 p.m., I'm your host, Chris Moore. Funding for a Festival Showcase on Aspen Public Radio is generously provided by the Barnard Fane Foundation. We have two extraordinary women artists on today's agenda. Opera composers Missy Mazzoli and Janine Tesori are the first female composers ever to be commissioned by the Met Opera of New York. But before these premieres put Missy Mazzoli in the international limelight, Aspen is hosting a one-act opera called Proving Up, which you can see and hear this Tuesday evening at 7:30. First, though, let's talk with guitarist Sharon Isbin, the first female classical guitar superstar and the founder of the Juilliard Guitar Department. Sharon, I know everybody looks forward to your concerts every year, and I think we should probably start by saying that August 10th, you have an almost completely different program this time because Jessica Rivera is coming in and has a different repertoire that is probably her strength.
Right.
So let's talk about that. What can people look forward to on August 10th that might not be on the poster calendar that they have?
So it's no longer an all-Spanish program, but it is an all-song-inspired program. So I'm going to open the concert with a masterpiece by Benjamin Britten, the only work that he wrote for solo guitar, and it's called The Nocturnal. It's actually based on a beautiful song by John Dowland, the Elizabethan composer, called Come Heavy Sleep, which is imagery about sleep and death. And what Britten did is create a series of variations, which ends with a passacaglia. And then finally, at the end, it goes to the actual John Dowland song and theme, and the guitar plays all of that by itself. So it's really a remarkable way of sonically exploring through music different states of agitation, dreamlike, little goblins coming to you at night and scaring the dickens out of you while you're having nightmares. It has a beautiful rocking feeling. It has all of these things that are parts of states of sleep. Yet he plays with the idea of sleep and death being almost synonymous and interchangeable.
What I find interesting about that right away is that the Daniel Poor poems are, I guess, about awakening on a spiritual level, the poems of Rumi that he has set to music. Tell us about that and its connection to Aspen with Joan Harris and Carnegie and all those different things.
Yes, the piece that we're going to play right after the Britten Nocturnal for solo guitar is with Jessica Rivera. I'm very excited to meet her for the first time and perform with her for the first time. She's an extraordinary artist. I've listened to her recordings and I'm delighted that she's able to join me in this concert. The work that we're going to do to end the first half is by Richard Danielpour, the American composer who has Persian roots. And this is a work that was commissioned for me and Isabel Leonard in 2015 for our Carnegie Hall recital by both Carnegie Hall for their 125th anniversary and a co-commission with the Harris Theater in Chicago, which of course is Joan Harris. So it's going to be an Aspen Music Festival debut here, and we're excited to bring that to the audiences. The poetry that Richard Danielpour based this on is by Rumi. They're very exotic and actually erotic and beautiful. The first movement is about the agony of birth, and the second movement is called This Night of Love, so you can imagine what that is about.
It contracts my heart.
And the third is about the ecstasy of death. Mm-hmm. So the lyrics are very much a guide to the listener. The music is quite tonal, and you'll be able to explore all that beauty within his context of language.
One of the other things that I see happening every time all of us are here, whether we be musicians or people like me or whoever, is that there are a lot of very, very strong connections. I did not know that Leonard Slatkin was so important in your career. And he just conducted recently here at the Aspen Music Festival, and you were in line to talk with him. Tell me how the two of you started your musical relationship.
Well, this goes back to the 80s when I had a concert in St. Louis, and he was the conductor of the St. Louis Symphony, and Joe Schwantner was the composer in residence. Mm. Mm-hmm. So I met with Joan Bricetti, who was the manager of the symphony, and she arranged for me to meet with Joe Schwantner, and he was really excited about the idea of writing something for guitar because, unbeknownst to me, he had actually studied the guitar at one point. And when he was 18 mm-hmm. years old, he had to choose when he went to a music camp, would he take guitar lessons or would he take composition lessons, because they met at the same time. So he chose the composition route and the rest is history. Mm-hmm. So when he wrote the piece for me, From Afar, a concerto for guitar and orchestra that I premiered with the St. Louis Symphony, Leonard Slatkin was the conductor. That was my first connection with Leonard, and we have performed together a number of times. In fact, most recently, last year, I did the Brubeck concerto that Chris Brubeck wrote for me called Affinity. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that is also on a new CD that will come out in 2020 called Affinity, named after the piece, in time for Brubeck's father, Dave Brubeck's 100th anniversary. Mm-hmm. Which is being celebrated in the 2021 season. So the recording that I did on the album Affinity is with Elizabeth Schulz conducting the Maryland Symphony at the Strathmore Hall. Interestingly enough, it's the first commercial recording ever done at Strathmore, so mm-hmm. they're excited about it too. Mm-hmm. And the concept of the album, which does include the Danielpour, and you're going to be able to play a sneak preview from that, the concept of the album is all this is music composed for me, so it includes music by Leo Brower and Tan Dunn as well. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I even, as a nod to the future generation, I asked Colin Davin, who's joined me here in Aspen a number mm-hmm. of times and had been my fellowship teaching assistant, I asked him to write a second guitar part to the famous waltz Natalia by Antonio Lauro, and what he came up with was so spectacular that I said, let's record that and put that on this album.
Wow,
since
that's
you wrote that second guitar part for me to play with you. So that's on there as well.
Mm-hmm. You were talking about going way back to the 1980s. Another thing that has happened in your life that has been celebrated is the fact that Juilliard's guitar department was founded by you. What was it, 1989?
Well, this is now going to be the 30th anniversary. Mm-hmm. And we now have a complete collection of not only a bachelor's degree, master's degree, but we just started a doctoral program. Mm-hmm. And I have a student who just received her master's who will be the first doctoral candidate. And Bakyung Yoon, who is my fellowship teaching assistant here in Aspen, received both her bachelor's and her master's with me at Juilliard, and she was the first bachelor's candidate.
So how do they celebrate?
We haven't figured that out yet, but I'm celebrating.
How do Juilliard people celebrate? Yeah, right.
We have
a serious bunch
that.
In some ways,
yes.
I know. Okay. Sedil Records, anybody who saw the Ruth Bader Ginsburg documentary knows that her son runs that company. So you're making a recording with that company. Does this mean you also get to meet this very esteemed Supreme Court justice at some point when that recording comes out?
Well, Ruth Bader Ginsburg's son is Jim Ginsburg, mm-hmm. and he created Sedil Records, which is based in Chicago, and it happens to be the label that the Pacifica Quartet, mm-hmm. which is very familiar to Aspen here. They're a big favorite in Aspen Music Festival. That is the label that they have been recording with. So they invited me to join them on an album mm-hmm. and to do a recording of a rarely done work by Mario Castelnuovo Tedesco, the Italian composer who had to flee Italy during the Nazi time period, came to the United States and settled in California. It's called Souvenirs of Spain and Italy. And the album's release date is August 23rd. It can be pre-ordered mm-hmm. now at Amazon or at the Sedil label, any way you like to go. I'm just so excited about it. The Pacific Quartet is brilliant. And like much of the magic of Aspen and the festival here was one of the collaborations that began right here at the festival. So when I was doing a recital in 2016, I invited them to join me and we really hit it off. So they said, would you like to tour with us? And I said, absolutely. So we've been playing together since our Aspen debut in 2016. And now this album will come out August 23rd. Can be pre-ordered now through Amazon, and it is just really a joy and delight for me to have been able to put this into a recording with them. So the Castelnuovo Tedesco Quintet, that rarely performed and rarely recorded work, was written for Segovia in 1950, and it came about when Segovia was performing a concerto by Tedesco, and a chamber music organization in California said, we'd really like to have you, Segovia, come and play for us next year. And Segovia thought about it and he said, well, I really need some repertoire. So he asked Mario, hey, would you write me a quintet? He said yes. And by the next year it was done and it was premiered. So that's how it happened.
I can't understand why that work is not more loved and known.
Because it is so hard.
It is so beautiful.
So hard. I had to practice 15 hours a day. Now,
okay.
I performed it here in Aspen 20 years ago with the American String Quartet. They did a spectacular job. And I went back and I listened to that recording and I thought, well, I did it then. That can't be too hard. And then when I went to the music, I thought, oh my goodness, this is really much tougher than I thought. How did we ever do it? So, and it's hard for every instrument. It's really a solo vehicle for each instrument. And the interactions and the way Castelnuovo Tedesco, he was so proud of this piece. He said it's the best piece of chamber music he's ever written. And he really felt not only amongst all his guitar pieces was this a diamond, but amongst all of his music, that this was something really, really special and one of his best efforts. So there are four movements. First movement is fast. The second movement is luscious and slow with a lot of lyricism. And Souvenir d'Espagne is one of the elements that Tedesco writes in some of the portions of the music to give the feeling of Spain. In fact, Tedesco's ancestors had to escape the Grand Inquisition. They came from Spain. And they fled to Italy. God. So he is an Italian composer with Spanish roots. And then also on the album, we have a work by Baccherini. Baccherini lived in Spain the latter part of his life. And the piece that he put together among his several quintets for guitar and string quartet is this particular one in D major that has the famous Fandango at the end. Now, the Fandango is about as Spanish as you can get.
Yes.
And Baccherini was certainly influenced by Spanish music that he heard. So another Italian composer who lived in Spain and was influenced by Spanish music. In this particular rendition that I do with the Pacifica, we also invited a marvelous castanet player from Brazil. And he is joining us both playing castanets and tambourines in this final Fandango movement. It was interesting because around that time period, when Casanova was visiting Spain and saw the Fandango being danced, he described it as one of the most lascivious things he'd ever seen in his life. Now, coming from Casanova, that means something.
Yes, it does.
And he said, when you look at these couples dancing this piece, it would be impossible for one to refuse the other.
Well, you mentioned the story of Castelnuovo Tedesco. I know he came over to the United States to escape fascism.
Yes.
I did not know that his family also had to escape the Inquisition.
That's right.
This is so much a part of our American story, which this Being America theme is about at the Aspen Music Festival.
Absolutely.
I don't know if you want to say anything about that, not only with Castelnuovo Tedesco, but with others. It's such a tragedy in many ways that America's cultural life was so enriched by the horrors of World War II and even World War I and pogroms before that within Russia against the Jews and all the different things that have happened. But life in the United States wouldn't be the same without that mass emigration, I guess you might say, from
That's
other countries.
Very true. And when you think about how few were allowed in because of the quotas and because of the State Department, the Director Long, who was an arch anti-Semite and wanted to keep as many Jews out as possible. Thanks to him, millions died.
Right.
And Roosevelt wasn't really much help, to be honest, during that time period, sending people on the St. Louis back to their deaths in Europe. It's a tragedy beyond proportions that we can even contemplate. Those who made it, like Castelnuovo Tedesco, and many others have so enriched our lives as human beings.
I think when we look at how the United States has been enriched by people who have immigrated here,
yes,
and all the Nobel Prize winners, I think a majority of Nobel Prize winners in the United States came from foreign countries first.
Fascinating.
This is something that we really need to be careful about, I think, when we choose our policies about who we let in and that sort
of
thing.
Well, we're all immigrants, really. I
exactly.
mean, unless you're Native
American.
A Native American Indian, everybody else came from somewhere else. And mm-hmm. that is our culture, and that is the beauty of it. And our diversity is something to celebrate, and welcoming people who have different perspectives and different backgrounds and can contribute to science and to music and to literature and to art. All of that is just a greater boon for humanity, and closing those doors is the wrong approach.
Sharon, we're running out of time, but I look forward so much to your concert, as I always do and as many do. If you're lucky, you can still get tickets. Sharon Yasmin is performing on August 10th with Jessica Rivera. And thank you again for making the time to come out here, as you always
do. Absolutely. Thank you so much. And please, all of you listeners, go to your favorite CD provider and order a copy of Souvenirs of Spain and Italy, the new album with Pacifica. It also includes a Vivaldi concerto for guitar and a work by Joaquin Turina, which was written actually for lutes of different sizes, not quite like the lutes that we have today. And then Turina, recognizing that that wouldn't work so well in terms of grand popularity, he then did a version for string quartet. And that is the version that the Pacifica does without me. So it's a beautiful work. The whole album I'm really excited about. The release date is August 23rd, but it's available now.
Have a wonderful time meeting one of your heroes, Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Yes, I look forward to that.
When you get to perform for her.
That will be in the beginning of September for the big fundraising gala in Chicago for Sedile Records.
Right. And in this case, this is a quote-unquote political figure who genuinely loves and understands music and the voice. And so it will be a very receptive audience.
Yes, she is a national treasure. And I'm thrilled to even breathe the same air that she is.
If you've just joined us, this is Festival Showcase, and we've been talking with guitarist Sharon Yasmin, who hosts free guitar masterclasses Saturday, July 27th at 12:30, Wednesday, July 31st at 12:30, Friday, August 2nd at 12:30, Sunday, August 4th at 12:30, and Tuesday, August 6th at 12:30. Then she performs with Jessica Rivera August 10th in recital. Now let's hear from opera composer Missy Mazzoli in anticipation of her one-act opera called Proving Up, which you can see and hear this Tuesday evening at 7:30 at Harris Hall. Well, Missy, before we even talk about Aspen, I have to congratulate you because I just found out that you've received a commission to put an opera onto the Metropolitan Opera stage in New York. So congratulations. That is fantastic to hear that.
Thank you so much. It's a dream come true.
It is, and I think that for those of us in Aspen who are going to see Proving Up, kind of like a one-act opera, I guess, by comparison, that we'll be mm-hmm. able to say that we knew you when, because not as many people know you now as are going to know you after the Metropolitan Opera stages your work. So this is great.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Proving Up, though. I can see a number of very interesting challenges that you and your librettist must have had to deal with. One is just how you can come to a real understanding of what it's like to be not only in a rural environment, because there's such a split in the United States now between like rural and urban environments, but also in the 1870s, that the life and death scratching an existence out of the earth, which is something that is not likely that you've had that kind of experience in your life. Can you talk about what it means for you and the librettist to really get into the mindset of people in the 1870s trying to survive in the Homestead Act?
Sure. Yeah. Well, I mean, thankfully, I've never experienced most of what goes on in my operas.
Right.
And thankfully, these are general works of fiction, so very much based on real life. I'm very grateful to not have to be scrounging in a five-year drought in the 1870s in Nebraska. But, you know, Royce and I do a lot of research. And Royce actually grew up on a farm in Alberta, Canada, northern Alberta, Canada, so a very isolated community. And I grew up in a rural community in Pennsylvania. So there's, you know, a little bit of experience from our childhood. And we did go to Nebraska as we were researching this opera and as we were writing it to really soak in the atmosphere and soak in the landscape, literally the land, you know, to walk on the dirt. We went to the Homestead National Monument in Beatrice, Nebraska, which is the site of the first homestead in America, and it's now a sort of monument, which is incredibly moving. And so we, you know, we do try to really be in the spaces where these operas take place. But at its core, you know, this is an opera about the American dream. This family is a representation of all American families to some extent. And the way that we grapple with the American dream, aspirations, the role of fate in our destinies. So yes, it's about this fictional family, the Zegners, but it's really about these much bigger ideas.
Well, it seems to me from what I've read that it's like Little House on the Prairie gone sour. I mean, it just, all the things that you might have seen in that TV story, I guess, were what they were hoping would happen to them. And then everything just goes south.
Little House on the Prairie, and also most of American history, is something that is usually written by the winners. And we tell the stories of these successful homesteads and these people who came from nothing and literally, you know, were going across walking behind their covered wagons and then like throwing out on the way anything that wasn't absolutely necessary. So really coming from nothing, moving out west and making a huge life for themselves and their families. Those are the winners. And that was true. You know, that's a true part of our history, but only for about 30% of homesteads. And most homesteads did not make it. So my interest is not in repeating the stories of the winners, which I think have been, you know, obviously grossly inflated. And I wanted to tell the story of a family who did everything right and still failed. And I think that that is something that America is grappling with right now. What happens when you do everything right, when you do everything you're quote-unquote supposed to do, and you're still struggling?
The story actually was originally created from a short story by Karen Russell, and then you and your librettist worked it out, and the libretto writer, of course, does this. Now, I've read stories about Giuseppe Verdi with his librettist being a really bossy and just saying, this doesn't have enough passion, this doesn't have enough oomph or enough blood and guts in it, rewrite the whole thing. What was your relationship like with the librettist? Because I don't imagine in the 21st century that composers and librettists behave like that with each other.
No. I mean, well, they do, but we don't.
Right.
Royce and I, Royce Vavrick and I are best friends. So I think that that's a very, we're in a very unique position in that we live a mile away from each other in Brooklyn. We see, when we're in town, we see each other almost every day. We talk about our work every day. And Royce is one of the best collaborators, probably the best collaborator I've ever had in my entire life. He's incredibly flexible. He's incredibly understanding. He understands that my needs as a composer are different from the needs of other composers he works with, like David T. Little or Du Yun. Yeah, we have a fantastic working relationship. And I honestly hear horror stories going back to Verdi, but also about contemporary composers who do not get along with their librettists. And I just think, what a nightmare.
I can only imagine.
I don't know how you make the work when you can't speak to your collaborator.
It's almost worse than a bad marriage, I imagine, you know.
Yeah.
Now, you've made some very interesting choices. This is a one-hour work. And yet, not only do we have this whole family trying to make it and scratch out an existence on a new farm that they may or may not even get the rights to own, but then on top of that, you have a sock puppet called Pig. You've got ghosts. I guess you've got some sisters or something. I don't know the exact story, but it seems like an awful lot is happening in this 1 hour. Is this as fast-paced an opera as I imagine it is from just what gets packed into that 1 hour?
There's a lot going on, yeah. There's a lot going on until our villain emerges. Energetically, I always felt that this opera goes very fast in one direction until about 40 minutes in when the villain appears, and he appears at the end of the stage and holds out a hand and says stop and pushes it in the other direction. So that's a very sort of abstract way to think of it, but that's how I see the momentum of the piece, and that it's like, we're going to make it, optimism, moving forward, stopped by fate, by this man.
Now, you also have, I know at least in the original production, the set was very sparse, and I think this is for a chamber ensemble, not for a symphonic orchestra. I imagine those two things were probably chosen to kind of capture the sparseness of the lives of these people, too.
Well, you know, I mean, theater is funny. It's like, it was also to capture the sparseness of our budget.
But...
I think that, you know, that decision to have orchestra was just part of the original commissioner, which is Washington National Opera. They were the first people to produce the production of it a year and a half ago. And that was part of the deal. You know, no matter what story we did, it was going to be a sparse staging and a 13-piece chamber orchestra. So I knew that going into it. I did pick the instrumentation based on these families' circumstance. This is a family in the opera that is living through a drought. They have basically almost nothing that isn't totally essential. So for me, it was like, what is the sound of dryness? What is the sound of evaporation? What is the sound of constant wind? That's why I made decisions in the orchestra to have instruments like the harpsichord. There's 8 acoustic guitars that the percussionists hit that are all tuned to different chords. There's a sort of rattling string technique, and that's all depicts the drought. And then there's also these harmonicas that the orchestra members play and the singers play, which is sort of like this constant wind that's like rushing through the prairie.
Well, the harmonicas brings up another question. It was going to be my next question, actually. A lot of times when an opera writer or classical composer is writing about the countryside, like say Carlisle Floyd's Susanna, there's a lot of ethnic, I guess you might say, but, you know, music of that time and place in a way that they're kind of orchestrating, and but it still sounds like a hoedown or something. Does your music avoid that, and do you have a musical language that is not just hearkening back to 19th century Nebraska folk music?
Yeah, I incorporated a little bit of that in this piece, but it's all twisted into the sort of like dreamy / nightmare-y vision of this story. And opera itself is so surreal that I rarely, if ever, just directly quote other music or music from an earlier time. You know, it's all sort of twisted through this lens of the surreal lens of opera when you bring it onto the stage. I did do a lot of research into folk music of that time, and particularly songs that were written to encourage westward expansion. So the opera actually begins with a song that was written in 1848. I should say the lyrics of a song from 1848. I've rewritten the melody and orchestrated it in my own weird way. But it's a song called Uncle Sam's Farm, and it was written to encourage people to go west and homestead. And the chorus is, come along, make no delay. Come from every nation, come from every way. Our lands, they are broad enough, don't be alarmed. Uncle Sam is rich enough to give us all a farm. So just even that, I get chills just even like reciting the chorus, given what's going on in our country today. You know, come from every nation, come from every way. Like, they were just desperate to populate the West with anyone who is not a Native American. So yes, I'm drawing on that. And then there's like also some old-timey fiddle techniques that I'm sort of referencing throughout the opera as well.
Mostly, though, it is your style. I mean, people would think of this as a folk-based opera or anything of that sort at all. Well, Missy, I'm very, very much looking forward to seeing this opera. I know not much more about this than the average audience member that's going to walk in the door. But Aspen is a wonderful place to do this because the audience here is very open. So I hope you have a wonderful experience here in Aspen. We look forward to welcoming you.
I can't wait to be there. Thank you for talking to me.
Opera composer Missy Mazzoli talking about her one-act opera, Proving Up, which you can see and hear this Tuesday evening at 7:30 at Harris Hall. This has been Festival Showcase, a weekly program exclusively on Aspen Public Radio, where we talk to the musicians, composers, conductors, and the movers and shakers from the Aspen Music Festival and School during the festival season, Fridays at 2:30 p.m. Funding for Festival Showcase on Aspen Public Radio is generously provided by the Barnard Fain Foundation. I'm your host, Chris Moore. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll tune in next week. This is Aspen Public Radio, broadcasting at KAJX Aspen and KCJX Carbondale.